All right. Lawyer talk off the record, on the air, since the dawn of our system, maybe even going back before the United States, back to the Salem witch trials, and then all the way forward, are like, we love a good criminal trial. Our society loves it. And this is probably true going back to English common law as well. I won't go back any further, but we love it. You know, we like picture the town square, a crowded town square, a crowded courtroom in To Kill a Mockingbird, this scene either in the book or the movie, whichever you prefer. The balconies of the courtroom are full. The lower levels are full. The town is full. Like, and you hear them, you see these old scenes in the movies where he's not guilty and everybody starts screaming from outside. And it used to be that trials were like the modern, or like the modern version of Shakespeare. They're like plays that unfolded. Now, we didn't have movie, or maybe at a time we didn't have movies, or maybe even we didn't even have radio. Criminal trials were a lot different. Clarence Darrow famously would have given day or several day long closing arguments. He's a famous lawyer. I'm not going, that's a different history lesson. But, you know, trials were a lot longer. Lawyers were a lot longer winded. Our attention span was a little bit more in tune with that kind of thing. But people, the concept's the same. We loved trials. Think like the OJ trial or the Lindbergh murder. It's like people love it. And as time has evolved, it's sort of created this question. Like, when is media, should media be allowed in the courtroom? Should cameras be allowed in the courtroom? Should reporters even be allowed in the courtroom? And how does it all fit together and how does it all work? And you can just see there's this milkshake of concerns that people have had that all sort of came to a head, at least in popular parlance, with the Charlie Kirk murder trial, where recently the lawyers argued on behalf of, I forget the defense, on behalf of the alleged killer, I'm drawing a blank, anyway, that the cameras and the media should not be allowed in the courtroom. They didn't want it televised, rather, and live streamed. Now, the judge says, no, we're going to let the cameras in, so not to bury the lead, the cameras are going to be there and we're all going to get to watch the trial. But what are the rights? You know, so, you know, on the one hand, we have this, if you read the Sixth Amendment, it says we have this right to a speedy and public trial. Well, the U.S. Supreme Court is there. Naturally, the media folks have argued that that means that they should have a right to be public, that they should have, the public has a right to be there. But that's, the Supreme Court has said, look, that's not the media's right. That's the defendant's right to a speedy and public trial. And so that doesn't really give the media an absolute right to be at trial, which means that for good reasons at times, the trial courts and state and federal courts can exclude cameras. And even to this day in federal court, there's no cameras. There's no TV cameras. We still have sketch artists, believe it or not, mostly. So, you know, there's not that, you know, that doesn't mean reporters can't be in there, and it doesn't mean that the news can't report, and it doesn't mean somebody, sometimes there's other recording devices, actually audio recording devices, but it still requires some permission. Now, what about a situation like where the defense team was arguing in the Kirk case that, look, this is prejudicial. There's a line of cases. So it starts going way back, a case called Estes versus Texas, which sort of the dawn of TV cameras in courtrooms. And the judge says, look, you know, this carries with it, see if I can find the language here, a certain influence. And I think at that point, cameras were new. It was sort of a new phenomenon, and it was somewhat questionable whether, so here we go. The court has, changing my course here. The court has recognized the concern that cameras may subtly affect participants in Estes versus Texas back in 1965. The court reflects that the constitutional problem in that earlier era was the hypothesis that mere presence of cameras and recording devices might have an effect on trial participants prejudicial to the accused. That was Justice Harlan talking about this. And he also warned that this can introduce, quote, professional showmanship with a subtle capacity for serious mischief. All right. Fast forward to 1981. There's another case called Chandler versus Florida, where Florida was sort of a pilot program putting cameras in courtrooms. And again, not to bury the lead, the Supreme Court in Chandler says, look, we're not going to create a constitutional rule banning automatically cameras in courtrooms. And basically, here's how it comes. Like, we're going to create yet another wishy-washy standard in the law, which says, okay, the defense can sometimes argue to ban cameras if it's really actually prejudicial, meaning you have to articulate some reason why it might be prejudicial. It can't just be, look, it may hurt me if these cameras are here, it may cause prejudice or it might have some impact on the jury. You have to be able to point to something. What is that something? Well, look, that's good. That's what good lawyers are all about. They got to figure it out in the context of their particular case and be able to articulate or tell the judge on the record what the exact concerns are. That's the kind of standard that puts enough discretion into the decision-making process that it's almost impossible to define and meet on a regular basis. So I don't know what that would be in any given case, but clearly in the Charlie Kirk case, even though it's all sensationalized and there's opinions on it and everything else is going on, there wasn't enough in that case. So, the lawyers probably knew that, by the way. And I'll tell you a little bit about strategy. I mean, they are challenging things on behalf of their client that can impact the outcome, and they're making constitutional arguments and they're preserving the record on these constitutional things. In the event they lose the case, they will then have issues to appeal later constitutionally, and that's going to be one of them. I think the other side of the coin is what's the speedy and public trial all about in the first place? I think the idea was, look, we don't want secret proceedings in our system. We don't want kangaroo courts in the basement of the courthouse and our elected or even appointed officials deciding crap or making legal decisions in secret. Our system loves sunshine. Our system loves I don't know if it loves it, but it certainly needs sunshine. It needs attention. It needs the eye of the public. We, the people, make our system the best, not perfect, but we make it the best. And when we give the power to the government to do everything in secret, you end up, go read it. There's a great book called Darkness at Noon, Arthur Kessler. It's about the Russian purges. Nobody now will care about it, but you end up in those sort of, those old kangaroo courts where gross government abuse occurs in the dark and nobody knows about it. So you have to have sunshine on the system, which is why the defendant has a right in public to have his trial seen, because then in theory, the government's less likely to overreach because now everybody can see it. There's no secrets. And that keeps maybe that's a check and balance that keeps our system, again, not perfect, but better than all the others. All right. So any questions about that, leave it in the comments, leave it in the show, wherever you leave it, or go to lawyertalkpodcast.com. Love answering questions. Lawyer Talk Off the Record on here. By the way, we're sponsored by Circle 270 Media. Phenomenal. If you've got a podcast that you want, if you're in the Central Ohio area, even nationally, great podcast consultant, check out Circle 270 Media. Brett over there will take care of you.